Hello, I'm Kirsty Young. Thank you for downloading this podcast of Desert Island Discs from BBC Radio 4. For rights reasons, the music choices are shorter than in the radio broadcast. For more information about the programme, please visit bbc.co.uk/radio4. My castaway this week is the broadcaster Bob Harris. Known affectionately as Whispering Bob, he's rarely been off our airwaves in the past 44 years. His big break came standing in for John Peel, and he was so good that not long after he was given his own show on Radio 1. Throughout the 70s, he also hosted the true music fans must-see show, The Old Grey Whistle Test. His beard and tank top were almost as legendary as some of the guests. The Rolling Stones, Led Zeppelin and John Lennon were among the lineup. However, with the arrival of punk, things got personal, and not in a good way. The closest his family ever got to showbiz was when his dad, a policeman, clambered on stage to arrest the singer PJ Proby when his trousers split. And young Bob did, for a while, follow his dad into the force, but he couldn't stick at it. Music, above all else, radio, were his obsession. Much like his recording heroes, his own life has something of the rock and roll vibe. Three wives, eight children, a spell of bankruptcy and coping with cancer. Yet through it all, his skill, knowledge and love of broadcasting has always endured. He says, "I'm a music anorak, a fan who got lucky. From the moment I bought my first record, aged 11, I couldn't wait to share music with others." And the fan who got lucky, when we talk lucky, we should probably just define how lucky. You've been right at the centre of a kind of who's who of rock, really. Led Zeppelin, the Stones, the Beatles, Bowie, Van Morrison, The Who, the Beach Boys, Sandy Denny, Emmylou Harris. You've spoken to them all. You really did luck out. And there's this great broad smile across your face when I mention them all. Do you still feel like a lucky man?
Absolutely. I mean, I can't believe it, really, that I'm still here. And right in the middle of everything, you know, I just sort of thank my lucky stars.
What about live performance? I get the feeling that that in particular is something that is central to your existence.
Well, here we come to one of the aspects of how lucky I am, because musicians come into my studio almost week by week to perform short sets for me in the studio. People that, you know, who I've really admired through the years. It's just an incredible thing, you know.
And even in some cases not in the studio, I understand that James Taylor and Carly Simon gave you a very private performance on one occasion. Do tell me about that.
We were doing filming in America for the Old Grey Whistle Test, and we were invited to their house on the island of Martha's Vineyard. And we were there for 3 days, literally, and it was just incredible, Kirsty. It really was. They set up in the sitting room, and the two of them just sat around the piano, acoustic guitar, and just played some songs for us. It was just absolutely magical.
I am dripping with jealousy. You are famously independent, and there is an integrity about what you do. I wonder what it is you are listening for when you listen.
Music from the heart. Really. I think you can always tell when people don't really mean it, and you can always tell when they really do. There's a soul and a heart about the music. That's what I look for.
Bob Harris's list, then. How on earth did you narrow it down to eight? It must have been like a
so
kind of
tough.
Slow water torture.
Leaving John Lennon out was the most difficult of all, but he is kind of represented by one of the tracks later on.
Great, so. And I have to say, people won't be surprised to know it's a cracking list. Tell me about your first one, then. What are we going to hear?
Well, the first song was recorded in the late 1980s by a songwriter called Mark Jimeno, and it's the story of an independent, thinking American DJ. And the station is bought out by one of these big corporate companies who then impose on this station a playlist. And this particular DJ railed against this. So I really identify with this fella. His name is Rex Bob Lowenstein.
He guaranteed a larger audience, less confusion and higher points. But your drive time jock won't get to do his thing. Hey, he's not half bad. Tell me, what's his name? Well, his name is Rex Bob Lowenstein. He's frequently heard, he's seldom seen. His formula's simple and his format's big. I just play it, then you call him.
That was appalling what we just did there, wasn't it? 5 minutes, 26 seconds of that beautiful music and we cut it short.
Well, we didn't hear the full story.
No.
Is the thing.
I can only sincerely apologise. It was Mark Germino, we should tell people, and Rex Bob Lowenstein, and we heard him say they're frequently heard and never seen. You yourself were seen in the 1970s. You emerged out of the radio waves and onto people's television sets, 1972 with the Old Grey Whistle Test. People will be aware of this incredible voice that you have. You have two shows currently running on Radio 2 on a Thursday evening and a Saturday night. The Whispering Bob, where did the whispering bit come from?
Well, going into a television studio for me was an entirely different experience. And from the moment I sort of stepped into the studio, I felt slightly overwhelmed by it all. And whenever I spoke, my voice seemed to echo back off the walls at me. And there's a real kind of one-to-one feeling about radio. There's an intimacy to it that I was trying to create when I went into Whistle Test. But both of these aspects then led to me being quite softly spoken. And it was within weeks, really, that I think it was a journalist called Michael Watts in Melody Maker coined the Whispering Bob phrase, and it's kind of stuck ever since.
And what about the look? The tank tops, the scarves, the long hair, the beard. I'm guessing you didn't have a stylist, am I right?
I didn't have a stylist. I was my own, can't you tell? It was my daughter, Flo, is 16, my youngest daughter, and she looks at some of these photographs and goes, "Daddy, what do you look like?" You know, I was a fashion...
You look like Mumford & Sons is what you look like.
I say to Flo, I was a fashion icon.
You were ahead of your time, Bob, I think. Over the years, with all of the people that you met and interviewed, particularly for Whistle Test, I know that John Lennon was one of your favourites. Would that be fair?
Absolutely my favourite. It was sort of September, October 1974.
Right.
And I went to a reception for the launch of a single called Lady Marmalade by La Belle. And as I was walking down into the venue, Elton John was coming up the stairs. So we chatted for a while and he said, "I'm on my way to do the American tour." And he said, "Don't tell anybody, but I think John Lennon's going to join me on stage." So I said, "Well, when you see John, tell him that we would love to do something with him on Whistle Test." And literally about 3 or 4 days later, I'm sitting in the office next to Mike Appleton and Mike's phone goes. And this voice at the other end of the phone says, "Could I speak to Bob Harris or Mike Appleton?" And I immediately knew it was John Lennon phoning himself to say, "Why don't you guys come over? I've got this rock and roll album coming out." So we went over and spent 3 days in New York with him. And the day that we recorded the interview was the day that Yoko had told him that she was pregnant with Sean. So you can imagine, he was so happy. It was just such a fantastic experience.
We're not going to hear John Lennon. Tell us what we are going to hear now, Bob Harris.
Well, one of the other people that were very, very important to me then and has been actually throughout my entire life is Robert Plant, because Robert and I first met when he was fronting Led Zeppelin. And the amazing thing is that Nashville drew us to it in sort of parallel lines. And the Americana Music Association hold an award show annually in September. And 2011, Robert and I both got an award. He got a Lifetime Achievement Award and I got what's called the Trailblazer Award. And we had this massive, massive hug at the side of the stage, you know, both of us saying, who would ever have dreamed 40 years ago that here we would be? And of course, one of the absolute links between Nashville and Robert was Alison Krauss and the Raising Sand album. So I thought it would be very appropriate to play a track from that.
And if you change your way, baby, you might get back to stay, baby. You better hurry up, you don't want to be alone, or I'll be gone.
Robert Plant and Alison Krauss and Gone, Gone, Gone. So, Bob Harris, you were born in 1946, the only child of Bryn and Doria Harris. Tell me about your mum and dad. Did they love music?
They did. My dad had the most fabulous melodic speaking voice and used to sing around the house the whole time. And my mum had an amazing and really true love of radio. And I remember, probably as a 3, 4, 5-year-old, growing up with what was a radiogram in the corner of the room, quite a big, chunky piece of furniture. And we used to sit round listening to Listen with Mother. You know, my mum had the radio going absolutely the whole time. And I'm sure that's where my love of radio began.
And your father, I mentioned when I was introducing you, your father arresting P.J. Proby when his trousers slit on stage. Do tell me more about that.
Well, P.J. Proby was touring, this is 65, I think it would have been, and there was huge controversy because he used to wear those sort of pantaloons, no underwear underneath, and the first night of the tour, his trousers split. So he's given this sort of warning. Anyway, the second night of the tour, the trousers split again, by which time, and wouldn't you know, the Daily Mail had got hold of this as a story, and loads of reporters and everything turned up for the third gig, which just happened to be the ABC Cinema Northampton. And my dad was in charge of the security, and about two numbers in, PJ Proby's trousers split again, and my father strode across the, sort of pulling the curtain to with him, and effectively kind of pulling the curtain to on PJ Proby's career, because it never really recovered from this ludicrous moment.
Your mum was responsible for your first ever mention on radio, a mention of your name. She was a big fan, as you say, a huge fan of radio, and David Jacobs.
David Jacobs, yeah. I was so sad recently when David passed away. My mum wrote to him to get a request played for me on my 15th birthday, and he did. He mentioned my name, and my mum then sent another letter to thank him. He replied to that letter, and so began a correspondence between the two of them, very occasional, that spanned all across the years. And when I started on Radio 2, at this point, David still hadn't made the connection, and I thought, I can't start on Radio 2 without coming out to David Jacobs. David was live down the corridor. So I went into the studio and said, you know Doré Harris? I said, well, that's my mum. And he was just so, I mean, he was an absolute gentleman, David.
Let's hear another piece of music then, Bob Harris. Your third disc of the morning. What is it and why have you chosen it?
Well, it's the first single I ever bought. I was on holiday with my mum and dad in Cromer and we walked past a coffee bar and this record was playing on the jukebox and I just thought, wow.
I'm so young and you're so old. This, my darling, I've been told. I don't care just what they say, 'cause forever I will pray. You and I will be as free as the birds up in the trees. Oh, please stay by me, Diana.
That was Paul Anka and Diana, and you said, Bob Harris, that was the first piece of music you ever bought. Can you date that? When would you have bought
it? 1957.
That?
And I'd say that it was fairly solitary, I mean, being an only child and everything. But the one thing I did do regularly was have loads of friends over for record hops. And we used to go down into the cellar of my mum and dad's house with my little dance set record player, and they'd bring over the new Buddy Holly single, and I'd play them the new Everly Brothers single. And, you know, I still think, honestly, that what I'm doing now, it's only just a slightly bigger version,
yes,
of that. Honestly, I think that, you know.
Is that, that was the beginning then, was it, of your love of the new? Of this is what people are doing,
yeah,
now. Listen to this thing
that, absolutely,
people have just imagined and made.
Yes, it was the love of the new, but also the love of seeing people's faces when you played them something that they really loved.
How did you get on in school? How were studies?
Oh, well, not successful. Uh-huh. I left school in a bit of a hurry in the end.
What happened?
Well, I was going into sixth form, and I was caught drinking half a shandy, and I got called into the headmaster's office, and he brandished the cane, and I said, there's absolutely no way. So I pedalled home, got all my school books, pedalled back to school again, and strode through to the headmaster's office and threw the books in and left school in a massive hurry.
Yes, I imagine your sense of righteous injustice sort of disappeared when your father, the senior policeman, looked you in the eye.
He was amazing, though. He said, OK, well, so now what are you going to do? Good question. You know, I really want to get into radio, but I mean, I'm living in Northampton. How do you join the dots?
And that's how you ended up as a police cadet, because I can't think of less of a fit.
No, he wanted me, very much wanted me to follow in his footsteps. And he said, if you give it everything when it comes to your 19th birthday, you honestly decide that it's not for you, then I'll back you in anything. And we shook hands on that.
And you kept to the deal and you were there for 2 years. I'm wondering what your worst memory of being a police cadet is.
Drill was absolutely horrendous. You know, having somebody 2 inches away from your ear going, get your ear cut.
And did you get your ear cut?
I did, absolutely. I just shot back and sides and, oh, Kirsty, honestly.
During those 2 years, did it really cement your idea that, you know, not only do I know I don't want to be a policeman, what I do want is to make my life in music and radio?
Yep, absolutely. Yeah.
Let's have some more music then. Tell me about this. It's your fourth.
Well, then, I moved to London, 1966. That's where I discovered pirate radio. Radio Caroline, Radio London, but Radio London was my station. And then, as I listened into the wee small hours, I discovered this chap doing a show called The Perfume Garden, playing this amazing music. There was a sense of community around this programme. It really touched me in a massive way. And I wanted to meet this person. And I met up with John Peel at the end of 1967. And I recorded an interview with him. And at the end of our meeting and conversation together, he already by this time had started calling me Young Bob. And he said, before you go, Young Bob, I want to give you an album which I think you'll like. And he gave me a copy of Forever Changes by Love. And when I got home and put it on, I put the needle on the vinyl, and the first track that I heard was this one, and it's Alone Again or All.
Yeah, said it's all right. Yeah, all the times I've waited patiently for you, and you'll do just what you choose to do.
Alone Again or from Love. So this friendship that you struck up, Bob Harris, with your hero, John Peel, your on-air hero, it led to you being introduced to BBC producers. And you did a pilot show for them. And as a result of that pilot show, you were asked to stand in for John Peel while he was on holiday. That must have been an enormous moment for you.
It was.
To actually even sit in his seat in his studio.
Absolutely. Just thinking about it now, you know, listening to that track again now, you know, John was my mentor. He guided me through the early days of my career and shepherded me into Radio One.
I mean, what sort of advice did he give you?
Just to be myself. I mean, he believed in me. He was prepared to step forward and help me and put me in touch with Jeff Griffin. That was the producer that he introduced me to. And even now, it feels like one of the biggest moments of my entire life, you know.
And were you at all gripped by nerves in front of the microphone?
Well, no. Actually, funnily enough, it felt like the most natural place for me to be. I mean, I'd been making up my imaginary virtual radio programme since I'd been, you know, about 12 or 13 years old. And it's like the footballers say, well, that 90 minutes I'm out on the pitch, the rest of the world falls away. You're just concentrated on that moment. And that's exactly how I feel in a studio.
Can you describe to me the professional technique, the way that the craft works of being a good DJ? What does it take? What are the skills? What are the things that you employ to make sure you're effective on air?
Well, I build my own programmes. I still do pick every piece of music you hear me play. And so the first aspect of it is programme building. And the imprint in my mind, if you can picture it, is a wave shape. Each piece of music somehow blending and lending itself to the next piece of music. And you've got moments of high tempo or intensity, and then you bring that back down again. You can hardly even tell where one track ends and the next begins. To me, then, that's most of the work done, if you know what I mean. All then I do on air is just provide a turning of a page as I move you from one track to the next. And then it's about the amount of information that I'm giving you so you're able to follow through on it. And if you like it, then you can get it yourself.
There would have been a time when you were at Radio 1 when you would have been working there at the same time as Jimmy Savile. And of course, we are entirely aware of the appalling details of the crimes that he perpetrated over the years. At the time, did people talk about him? Were people aware that there was something that was going on that shouldn't have been going on?
I don't think so. You know, for me personally, it was just this was somebody I didn't like. I mean, I never spent any time in his company. I mean, the last time that I saw him at all was about probably 6 or 7 years ago. There was a Radio Academy event. He was in his shiny jumpsuit with medallions and everything. And I was sitting with my wife, Trudy, and he came up and sort of grabbed her arm, kissed all up her arm. And, you know, it just, you just didn't get a good atmosphere off him at all. So he was never somebody that I spent any time around.
Let's have some music now, Bob Harris. Tell me what we're going to hear next.
Well, John having introduced me to Jeff Griffin and Jeff giving me this four-week stint sitting in for John, this was the very first track I played on that very first program.
I want to live with a cinnamon girl. I can be happy the rest of my life with a cinnamon girl. A dreamer of pictures, I run in the night. You see us together chasing the moonlight. My cinnamon girl.
That was Neil Young and Cinnamon Girl. So, Bob Harris, tell me about the arrival of punk then, because that did not sit at all easily with you. It's true, is it, that you got in a proper dust-up with the Sex Pistols?
Yeah, and there's always been a kind of misinterpretation of this, because at the time, Whistle Test was an album programme, and you had to have an LP out to appear on the show. Punk and New Wave exploded on singles that we weren't playing on the programme. Plus, I mean, if you're a young kid coming through and you're seeing this guy on Whistle Test, who's now 30 years old, long hair, hippie, white, middle class, stadium rock loving, I represented to them everything that they were trying to break away from and despised. And so this all then eventually it reached a moment where a friend of mine, George Nicholson, a recording engineer, and I called into a place called the Speakeasy in central London. And it was the day that the Sex Pistols had signed their contract. And they'd been down at the A&M offices during the day, fueling up is probably the best way of putting it. When we arrived at the Speakeasy about 10 o'clock, I don't know who it was. It was a guy taller than me in a green boiler suit. That's what I remember of it.
Right.
But somebody came over to me and said, when are the Sex Pistols going to be on Whistle Test? And I said, well, give us a call in the office. It didn't matter what I said. He took this haymaker swing at me and all hell broke loose. George and I got separated and I got pulled around the other side of the bar. And I had my back against a wall with half a dozen, eight, nine people coming towards me with broken bottles and broken glasses and stuff. And I thought, oh, this is it. I really thought that I was going to be badly damaged in the experience of this. Symbolically, a group of people got in between them and me, and it turned out to be the Procol Harum road crew. I mean, it's just the perfect snapshot.
You couldn't make it up.
I know. So they surrounded me and got me out of the building. And people ever since have said, oh, Bob Harris hated punk. Well, no, I didn't. But it's hard to remain objective when what's happening to you is everywhere you go now, there's an element of violence being directed towards you. It's not an easy thing to cope with.
Yeah. No Sex Pistols on your list, we should note. Let's hear another piece of music then, Bob Harris. Tell me about this. It's your sixth track of the morning.
Well, going back to what we were saying earlier about how fortunate I've been in my career, and one of the absolute sort of, you know, turning point moments was when Radio 2 asked me if I'd like to take over the country programme. And I'd never been to Nashville before. I'd always loved Nashville music. In fact, the theme tune from the Old Grey Whistle Test was recorded by a group called Area Code 615, which is the Nashville area code. And I don't know how I can explain this, but from just about the moment I touched down, I thought, this is my home. I just loved it there so much. And this track was released in 1950, soon after WSM, the greatest country music station in the world, had coined the phrase Music City, USA, to explain what Nashville actually is. So this song really kind of just explains all that.
You can hear them on your radio, wherever you are. Everybody jumping to the solid beat of a guitar, picking out an eight to the bar. So if you're living in some distant town, brother, pack your rags and come right on down. They used to call it Nashville, but I'm here to say that now we call it Music City, USA.
That was Dick Stratton in Music City, USA. You said that was released in 1950, Bob.
Yeah.
Can we talk for a moment about what I am euphemistically calling your rock and roll life? Because you've got eight children. You've been married three times. You now have many grandchildren, seven granddaughters. All
yes,
granddaughters.
Yes.
Do you feel like you've lived a rock and roll life?
No, not really. I don't. I would say that at certain times my work has taken me away, particularly to America. My first wife, Sue, and I are still really, really good friends. We've stayed really close throughout. And it did get a bit crazy towards the end of the 1970s. Suddenly my radio career is taking off. I was going out to gigs a lot, staying out late. Meanwhile, Sue, you know, we've just had our first two girls, Mary and Emily. So there was Sue at home with the girls and me out and about. As things grew, I find myself more and more and more in the center of where I really want to be, particularly going to America. But it and my family life didn't sit together easily at all.
What was the moment? Was it a moment? Maybe it was gradual. When you thought, that's not good.
I got ill, seriously ill, in the winter of 78 into 79. It was a form of Legionnaire's disease. And it was unbelievably vigorous. I've never been in so much pain. I then went into a five-day coma, out of which then, when I emerged, I thought, you know what? Maybe I should straighten up my lifestyle. I've just got to get well, clear my head, and sort of go again.
And for a number of years, you've been dealing with prostate cancer. As I met you today, you couldn't have seemed more bouncy and cheerful and positive. What's your attitude to dealing with it on a sort of weekly or daily basis?
Well, it was devastating to get the news originally. And not only that, but the cancer was particularly aggressive. I was fortunate, very, very fortunate to catch it in time. And then it was a question of arresting the growth and then treatment. I had 2 months of radiotherapy. And then since then, it's just been management. Every now and again, you know, all the readings will go shooting up. And that happened to me a couple of years ago where it looked as if it really got serious again. And I really needed to talk to somebody about this. And I phoned Robert Plant. He offers such unbelievably good advice. And he really saw me through that moment. And then once I got the all clear again, he said, fine, OK, well, I'm not going to be phoning you every single day now. So, you know, each person has their own way, don't they? And I just get on with it, basically.
Let's have some music now, Bob Harris. We're on your penultimate disc. Tell me about this.
Well, I'm spending so much time in Nashville now and discovering new artists all the time. And this time last year, a young artist came into the studio. I just absolutely fell in love with her music. And it turned out that the session she did for my program was the first radio session she ever did. And she represents the new generation of country artists, Kacey Musgraves.
Mary, Mary, quack and swear.
Kacey Musgraves and Merry Go Round. In 2011, Bob Harris, you were awarded an OBE for services to music broadcasting, and you were honoured recently with an Americana Music Association Trailblazer Award, which is really a very big deal indeed. The fact that Trudy, your wife, is very much involved in your career, you mentioned there that you've been travelling, you travel a lot to and from America to make documentaries and so on. Does she ever say to you, Bob, I think probably this year, just slow it down a bit?
Well, Trudy's a driving force, and I do work very hard. I don't think you can do it without the support of your family, you know, and she is absolutely 100% by my side. I mean, she's 20 years younger than I am.
So she's telling you to speed it up a bit.
She is actually, you know, making sure that the engine doesn't run out of petrol. Yeah.
To be cast away to a desert island then, of course you'll have your 8 discs, but you won't have much else. How will you cope on this island, do you think? Are you a doer?
Yes, and being brought up as an only child will give me some idea of how to cope with the solitude. And I have developed over recent years, and this is very un-rock and roll, a love of gardening. There's tubs of flowers all round the edge of the house, up on our balcony. There's colour everywhere around my studio. And over the last 3 or 4 years, I've got phenomenal pleasure out of just doing this.
Not very rock and roll, but very satisfying.
Yeah.
Let's have your final track then. Tell me about Discgate.
Simply, this is my favourite record of all time.
Is it? This
yes.
is. You can narrow it down to one.
Absolutely.
Right.
Yes. And from the moment I first heard it, this is where a John Lennon connection comes in, because I was hovering on playing John Lennon's version of this. But this is the original version. This is 1961, and this is Benny King.
When the night has come and the land is dark and the moon is the only light we'll see, no, I won't be afraid. Oh, I won't be afraid, just as long as you stand by me.
Benny King and Stand By Me. So, Bob, it's time for the books. The Bible and the complete works of Shakespeare are yours. What else are you going to take along?
I've been giving this a huge amount of thought. I need a little advice on this, Kirsty,
right.
But there's a website called Cricket Ratings. You can call up any player in history and get their stats, the way that bowlers and batsmen have been rated through the years. Now, I would like to be able to copy off the information from this site and take that information in the form of a book.
Now, people can't see how pleadingly you're looking at me right
That's
here,
right.
And I'm afraid I'm putty in your hands. I'm going to get into trouble for this. I will allow you that. It will be a book, and
Perfect.
It will be yours. And a luxury, too.
Well, bearing in mind my now love of gardening, I was thinking I can begin to kind of grow stuff on the island and become more and more sort of self-sufficient in that way. So I'd like to take a greenhouse.
Yes, you may indeed have a greenhouse. And I think I know the answer to the next question. Which one track would you say, if you sort of gave it away there as you were introducing the track?
It would have to be Stand By Me.
Right, it's yeah. yours. Bob Harris, thank you very much for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a download from the BBC. You'll find more information on the Radio 4 website, bbc.co.uk/radio4.